You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
ABC News correspondent and former NPR reporter Martha Raddatz has covered everything from the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin to the Elian Gonzalez case. More recently, she has been covering the war in Iraq, which led to a book called The Long Road Home. It's about the American soldiers serving in Iraq and the suffering of their families back home in the United States. She joined me earlier this year, and we are playing that again for you on this Labor Day. I began by asking Martha Raddatz when she first went to Iraq.
The first time I went was in the fall of 2003.
Is this something you volunteer for, or does ABC say, Martha, we need
you're going
you
to Iraq? No. First of all, I was the national security correspondent for the network at the time. So it was something I wanted to do, and I had covered the war from the State Department, the Pentagon, from the policy side of things, and I very much wanted to go in. I've been there a total of 12 times. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was there again. And I wanted to go in and see for myself. And frankly, I volunteer to go now. And I think it's important, particularly now, covering the White House, because it's the most important story, the most important thing going on right now, certainly for the president's legacy.
Well, in 2003, I don't know what you saw, but we were being given a rather rosy picture and a rosy prognosis. What did you see?
Well, the interesting thing to me is I went in with General John Abizaid, who's the head of Central Command, and he, on the airplane in, was talking about some of the trouble spots or slightly unstable spots. And I look back at that tape and those interviews now, and it's essentially the same places, but tenfold worse. They talked about Tikrit, and Tikrit has certainly calmed down since then.
Well, Tikrit was Saddam Hussein's hometown.
Yes, but Baghdad and the Al Anbar province, those are what he was talking about as we were flying into Baghdad in the end of September 2003 as trouble spots, and they certainly are today.
Well, do you think they thought these were easily handled troubled spots?
Well, here's one other thing he said, which I know we've heard a lot of this now. There is no military solution to the problems in Iraq. He said it then. They knew it then. There was no simple military solution to the problems. Did they know there was an insurgency? No. When I look back at those interviews, too, there was, I think General Abizaid gave a number of about 5,000 insurgents. And I think since then, we've probably killed or captured about 100,000 insurgents. So something went terribly wrong there. But they knew then there was no military solution. But the insurgency was just starting to blossom on that first trip, and no one knew it then.
And you went back, as you say, a number of times. Were you there on Black Sunday, April 4th, 2004?
I was not there for that battle. I found out about that battle a couple of months later, and I was in Baghdad. And just think about the pace of this story. I think I was on the air almost every day from the beginning of the war to talk about the invasion, then the next phase, then there were a few suicide bombings. And what happened to me during that period, the things were moving so rapidly, and I think for all reporters, it was almost like you couldn't keep track of the news. There was so much of it. So when I heard about this battle on a trip to Baghdad, a general said, you would not believe what this battalion went through. Do you want to talk to these soldiers? And I said, sure, and ended up in Sadr City, which is certainly in the news today, flew down, and they had about six soldiers lined up for me to speak to, and it was remarkable. To me, it was a turning point, because if I thought I'd covered the war before, I hadn't. I didn't think anybody realized the depth of pain, the depth of misunderstanding about what our soldiers were going through. This was an incredible day. In one day, in 2 hours, we lost eight soldiers. They'd been ambushed, a platoon. All these rescue squads went in to try to save them in open trucks. And by the end of that evening, the 1st Cavalry Division, which had just arrived in Iraq, had the largest loss of life in a single day since the Vietnam War.
Was it one of the trouble spots that General Abizaid had mentioned?
Absolutely not. In fact, this was, to me, a turning point in the war as well. This is a Shiite area, 2.5 million people in a 6 mile square area, horrible poverty, sewage running in the streets. Everyone believed this was an area that would be safe. And in fact, the prior year before the 1st Cavalry Division arrived, there was only one soldier who'd been killed in a year in Sadr City. And people thought, oh, this is an area that was so oppressed by Saddam Hussein, they'll love us. They'll just love us.
It was assumed that the insurgents would only be Sunnis.
Yes, yes.
And here we have this very powerful area of Shiism with Muqtada al-Sadr as the most important figure there. He has been described as one of the most powerful men in Iraq. How did he come to be so powerful?
Well, it's his history. His father was a revered cleric, and basically Muqtada al-Sadr hung on to the legacy and coattails of his father. He's young. Nobody's certain exactly how old he is, but he grabbed power, and because his father was seen as a martyr, he tried to take that mantle, and he's done a very good job of it, and he's basically followed the Hezbollah model. He rules Sadr City. He controls a good deal of Baghdad, or at least influential control in Baghdad, because he tries to provide services. He tries to let people know that it's Muqtada al-Sadr who's saving them, not the Americans. In fact, the night of this battle, he turned off the electric grid and blamed the Americans. And then a few days later, he turned it back on and took credit for that. But they never knew he'd turned it off.
But since this is such a devastated area, you say bad sewage and the like, doesn't anybody blame him? I gather that the soldiers who were ambushed were on sewage duty.
They were on sewage duty. That's exactly right. They had a team of Iraqis in sewage trucks, and they were escorting them as part of a security detail. Had really no indication in prior runs that anything would go horribly wrong. But do they blame him for the sewage? No. They blame Saddam Hussein for the horrible sewage problems. They blame the Sunnis for the horrible sewage problems. And when the Americans came in and everything wasn't instantly better, they all say, why didn't they make it instantly better? And whatever Muqtada al-Sadr provides, and he tries to provide jobs and he tries to provide anything he can, then he gets the credit.
When did American officials become aware of the growing strength of Muqtada al-Sadr and the insurgency that he was leading?
I think it hit them over the head, certainly, on that day, on April 4th, on what the soldiers refer to now as Black Sunday. And that's because when these soldiers, when this platoon went out on the sewage duty, by the end of the evening, there were thousands of al-Sadr supporters, the Mahdi militia, his army, and civilians, women, children, old people, out on the streets attacking U.S. soldiers. Then they took over the police stations that same night. This battle began 80 straight days of fighting.
But shouldn't people have been more alert to the problems here? Muqtada al-Sadr has also been linked to Iran, and many people understood from the start that Iran stood to gain an awful lot from conflict in Iraq.
I think one of the things they did is they just took for granted this would be a good area because it was Shiite, because they assumed, particularly in an area like this where they were poor and oppressed, that they would see the Americans as the saviors. Should they have known? Probably should have. What they were doing is they were keeping busy with areas, or they were concentrating on, as you said earlier, Tikrit areas, or Sunni areas, or El Anbar province. These are the areas that would be trouble. We have our hands full with those. The Shiites will be just fine.
The conventional wisdom was that
conventional, exactly.
Sunnis had been in control, and now they no longer had the majority. They were going to be the angry ones. The Shiites are going to be thrilled because now they were, through democratic elections, were going to wind up dominating the government.
That's exactly right. And the division, the military division that had been there the prior year in Sadr City, just thought, this place seems fine. Let's just let it continue. Now, there was one intelligence officer in particular, a young captain named Dylan Randazzo, who was with this battalion. And he started seeing a few signs. He went on a reconnaissance before they actually deployed. And he started seeing a few unsettling signs, one of them being that the military hadn't really patrolled very aggressively in those areas, hadn't really gone below the surface there. Everything looked fine, but nobody thought it really was. I mean, everybody thought it really was, but they didn't really know. And Dylan Randazzo wrote a report even before they deployed saying, let's just say a worst case here. Let's say a platoon's pinned down. They have no communications equipment. That was their worst case. Everyone thought he was a little gloomy, but that's exactly what happened.
And now there are some people who suggest that Muqtada al-Sadr has kind of opened up a Pandora's box when he tries to engage in the political process. He has all these people who were in his army, his body army. Some of them are freelancing, and they're off on their own, and they're no longer listening to his commands.
That's very wise of you to notice, because that's one of the questions I keep asking at the White House, because they'll say, and they'll put it as progress in Iraq, that Muqtada al-Sadr has gone back to the political process. I wouldn't necessarily think that's so great. Or that Maliki has now said it's okay if some of his followers are arrested or detained. The fact is, the ones Muqtada al-Sadr allows to be detained are the extremists in his organization. It might sound crazy to say they're extremists, since he's an extremist as well, but the real extremists.
So he really allows the people who are engaged in a power struggle with him.
Yes.
Now, you chose to write about Lieutenant Shane Aguero in great detail here. Why him?
Shane Aguero was the platoon leader. He was the one who was leading the platoon that got ambushed. He is also one of the soldiers I met on my first trip to Sadr City.
And by coincidence?
Because he was the platoon leader. And he had led this escort into the city and found himself. Now, none of these soldiers had been in battle. It was just extraordinary. They'd been in Iraq for 4 days, and they suddenly find themselves in this enormous battle. Shane Aguero's gunner, Eddie Chen, was killed almost instantly when the gunfire started. He was in the turret above the Humvee. There were four Humvees. Shane Aguero was in the lead Humvee, and suddenly they come under intense fire. And within 2 hours, they're in this alley. They have one dead, many wounded in their platoon, and none of the rescue squads can get to them.
In your book, you also speak to the people back home, the families of these soldiers. How soon was Shane's wife, Amber, informed about the attack?
She didn't know for days. And
is that typical?
She didn't know for days, because Shane, although he was injured, they'd heard a little bit about the battle. She heard a lot of these soldiers don't tell their wives a lot about it. They don't want them to worry more. And what was hard in this battle in particular is there started being a lot of reports about this, because this had been the biggest battle to date since the U.S. had gotten over there. And all these families thought their husbands were going on a peacekeeping mission, and they were not. So they thought, in fact, when the initial calls started coming in, they were saying, okay, we have two dead in combat. And the wives are saying, combat? Where? They weren't supposed to be in combat.
But haven't we heard that with the internet and all of the other quick means of communication today, that families back home are better informed than they would have been in any other previous war?
They're more in touch with their loved ones. They certainly are, and there are rumors that can start going around. One of the things they do over there, in fact, when I was over there a couple of weeks ago, a helicopter went down. And what they do with the unit I was with is they shut down the internet, because they don't want people to start saying, oh, you know, I heard a helicopter with seven people went down, and then worry all of the families. But you know what? It happens, because what happens is the wounded are allowed to call their families. And when that happens, then the rumor mill starts flying. The notification process in the military is the same as it has been for many, many years. And that is, before 10 p.m. at night and after 6 a.m. in the morning, there is a knock on the door. They don't do it in the middle of the night, because of the horrible thought that military families, if they have to go to bed thinking that they might be woken up in the middle of the night, would never be able to sleep.
My guest is Martha Raddatz. Her book, The Long Road Home, A Story of War and Family, is published by Putnam. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with three-time Emmy Award winner Martha Raddatz, who is the chief White House correspondent for ABC News and was the network's senior national security correspondent until 2005. Over the years, she has been to Iraq many times, and now she's written a book called The Long Road Home, A Story of War and Family, published by Putnam. Why that title?
I think, talking to some of the wives, one of the things they said is they knew their husbands were going to be on the ground at least a year. And when they started counting the days before they would come back, that was the day one of the road home. And this turned into such a long road home because the families thought, even though it was so horrible for them to imagine a year without their spouses, they never imagined what that year would be like. They thought it would be a somewhat peaceful deployment.
And then they were faced with, in some cases, extended tours of duty, people being sent back again and again.
Many of the soldiers in this story are now back because the 1st Cavalry Division is back in Baghdad. I visited with some of the soldiers, the battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Gary Valescu, who's now a colonel, who's now back in Baghdad. Shane Awero, who is the platoon leader, is in Afghanistan. This story is also the story of what these soldiers go through again and again.
Is there any ultimate limitation? I mean, can they just keep on going back?
They can keep on going back, you bet. And when you look at some of the rules that they've already bent in the military on deployments and on reservists and calling back and change the rules, one of the most incredible people in this book, Staff Sergeant Robert Miltenberger, who got a Silver Star, the interviews I did with him are heartbreaking, just heartbreaking. He'd never talked about this battle before, and I asked him about it, and he could not carry on. He talked about he was in an open truck, volunteered, jumped in this truck because he wanted to rescue his buddies, and within minutes in this open truck, he has his hand trying to stop an arterial bleed in the leg of one of the soldiers next to him who was eventually paralyzed, and a sucking chest wound on his right, and all the while he's firing his weapon. Robert Miltenberger shouldn't have been there. He tried to retire from the Army, and he was in the stop-loss program, that little small print program that meant his unit was deployed to Iraq, so he had to go. And he went, and he ended up being one of the heroes in this story.
You mentioned that he hadn't talked to anyone about this before, and I've heard again and again from families of people who served in World War II, in Korea, in Vietnam, that until books are written, they have no idea that this person went through all of those terrible experiences. Why do you think that is? Why do you think they... I understand on one level you just don't want to think about it. It's just too traumatic. But there's got to be something else. I know if I'd been through something really powerful, I'd want to share that with everyone.
That's because you're a journalist, and I would too. But I think the pain is deep. I think that is a culture where as much as they say, you know, you should talk about this and let's talk about it, it is not a culture where you really do that. And it's one of the gifts to me, and the one of the things I'm proud of with this is they talk to me. And I think one of the reasons they do, and one of the reasons the families do, is because I've been a connection between those soldiers and their families. I've been a bridge between them. I know what it's like to be in the battlefield. I know what it's like to be on the front lines. But I also know what it's like to be a wife and mother. And that I can talk to the soldiers and then talk to their families about what they went through. And the soldiers know that I understand what their families have been through. One of the reasons I wrote about the families is because I found that's all they were talking about. But to come home and share that, A, it's difficult, and B, they don't want their families to worry about it. I had one funny thing with a bunch of Marines once, and we were out on patrol, and there was rockets and mortars landed nearby, and the Marine said, I won't be telling my family about that. I wouldn't tell your family about that either if I were you, Martha. And I said, I've got a little problem here, fellas. My family watches TV, and I'm on TV, and you're going to be on TV too. So you better fess up to your families right away because they're going to see what happened to you today.
Do you think that this book will be read as just another one of those books that are critical of the decision to go into Iraq?
I hope not. I hope not. I hope this book, and I don't think this book, to me, and I tried to be scrupulously apolitical in this book, it was important to me. This tells the story of the soldiers and their families. It tells it in painful detail. It is graphic. You can take away from this whatever you want. But this is not an anti-war book. These are men and women who want to make this work, who want to make it succeed. Whatever reason we got there, they're there, and they're doing the best job they can. To me, it is an inspirational story. It isn't a... I mean, there are things that are heartbreaking in here. It is graphic. It is painful. But in the end, it is a story of courage, and it is a story of people who were given a job that they weren't prepared for in some cases because the administration thought it might be a much simpler task than it was, but they did the best they could.
Did you find that many of the soldiers you spoke to had family histories of serving in the military?
The military is so interesting, Leonard. When I started covering the military 12 years ago, I didn't really know anybody in the military. And what I found, what was so eye-opening to me, is it's so remarkably diverse. I mean, they're some of the smartest people I have ever met in the military. And I was telling someone the other day that I had lunch with an Army major and a captain, and they were telling me how, one of them went to Harvard and one of them was getting his PhD at Columbia University. And he said, you know, I meet people and they say, oh, you're in the Army? Couldn't you get a job in a civilian world? I mean, there are just remarkable people in there.
My guest is Martha Raddatz, and she's written a book called The Long Road Home, A Story of War and Family. It's published by Putnam. This is WNYC. And WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, you went back and you spoke to the families, mostly families that were near Fort Hood?
The 1st Cavalry Division is based in Fort Hood, Texas, so we spent a lot of time in Fort Hood. But there were other families throughout the country. And talking to the families is... no one in this country has sacrificed in this war. None of us, except for the families and those serving over there right now.
Because in many cases, the soldiers had jobs, had mortgages, had certain built-in lifestyle.
Yeah, it's
and
from
suddenly
the minivan to the Humvee. I mean, it is remarkable how they're sent up. And a lot of these soldiers, I mean, they don't have a military background. Shana Wera did. Shana Wera was a military brat. He grew up with a military father. A lot of them had no military background. And they hadn't ever been in battle before. They'd train. But to see it, I mean, one of the soldiers said, I just sat there, and it really took me a long time to realize this wasn't a bad movie. He said, the thing that snapped me out of it is I didn't want it to end like the bad movies I'd seen about this.
But many soldiers will tell you that they sit around, it's boring, and then suddenly they get up, and they know that in any instant they may be dead.
Yes. And I think one of the things that you see in Iraq, and I've noticed on the last couple of trips, now in this case, these soldiers were able to have their training kick in. They could grab their weapon, they could shoot back. One of the horrible things about this war, and I've heard a lot from soldiers and Marines over there now, is that they could just get blown up at any instance. It doesn't matter their training. They just drive away. And one of the things they're seeing with post-traumatic stress syndrome is this adrenaline rush. Because when you go over there, you could get killed at any time. I think in previous conflicts, like in Vietnam, and I don't have the statistics with me, but they would perhaps get in a firefight every 30 days. In this, every single minute of the day, they know they can get hit. There's no downtime. And I think what that does to them is they have a constant state of adrenaline working. The fight or flee is there almost constantly. And when they come back, some of them are having real problems adjusting because they almost turn into adrenaline junkies, some of them.
Did you speak to some of the wives who had to contend with that?
He came back
and he was a different man.
Yes. Now, Robert Miltenberger, who's the Silver Star recipient, 2 months after this battle, the one who was on stop loss, who didn't want to be there in the first place, who was, to me, a hero, to anybody who reads this book, was a hero. He can't stand to be called a hero. He clearly has survivor's guilt. He stood out in a street in Sutter City and opened his body armor and said, I'm here, shoot me, kill me. Now, I talked to Robert Miltenberger, and this poor guy, he comes back and his home is blown away in the hurricane after he finally gets out of the war. He's living in a FEMA trailer in Louisiana. And I went down and talked to he and his wife. And again, he won't talk to anybody about this battle but me. His wife, who's lovely, and they have a lovely marriage, Belinda, will sit right next to him and cry as he talks about this story, and he won't look at her. And he just talks, and I say, Robert, aren't you, do you have post-traumatic stress syndrome? He said, oh, they say I have. They say I have it. And I said, but you don't think you do? He said, I don't think I do. I said, do you think about what happened? Do you think about that scene in the back of the truck when everybody around you was getting shot? And he said, I do. And I said, well, do you want to stop thinking about that? Maybe you should get some help. And he said, ma'am, I'll never stop thinking about this.
But what about the help? I mean, you wrote this book before the scandals at the Walter Reed Hospital were revealed. But I imagine that families are worried about that sort of thing as well. He comes back and we're not going to be able to pick up where we left off. We're going to have real problems making ends meet. On top of it all, if he needs any kind of treatment, whether it's psychological or physical, there's a good chance it's not going to be adequate.
It's if we do not take care of our soldiers and Marines who have been in this conflict, it's a shame. The nation should be ashamed of itself. I have been going to Bethesda Naval Hospital for years. I have heard stories about people trying to get help at the VA as well. And this country was not prepared for the number of wounded, not anywhere prepared. When I go to these places and I see that families who are reservists in particular, they have a life, they live in Michigan. The husband is in Bethesda Naval Hospital. He's brain damaged. And the wife can't fly the kids out because the military only has so many vouchers per month where you can fly out. Or they can't pay the rent because the wife has to quit her job as a teacher to take care of the husband. I mean, there are several wonderful charities out there. There's a Semper Fi Fund, which is for Marines, which is one of the best funds for wounded Marines because they take money and they hand it right back to those families. This will help pay your rent. This will help fly your children out. Bob Woodruff, my colleague, has the Bob Woodruff Family Fund for Traumatic Brain Injury, which is a marvelous charity to help the wounded as well. But we as a country have to get a grip on this.
Now, Bob Woodruff was seriously hurt. Recently, I talked with Michael Weisskopf, Time magazine,
yes,
who had his hand blown off while he was in Iraq covering a story. So I wonder about you. You left family behind. I don't know whether they coped with it the same way that the military families coped with it, but what about you? Didn't you ever feel like you were in serious danger?
I think anybody who goes to Iraq is in serious danger. Journalists are always in serious danger.
Especially if you get out of the green zone.
Yeah, I never go to the green zone. I think it's hard on families. I think your families aren't prepared for that in the same ways. My husband covered wars before. He understands. He doesn't love this. I have a 26-year-old daughter who's in law school, and I have a 15-year-old son. When Bob Woodruff was injured, who she knows, she was horrified. And that really brought it home. And that was very hard.
But you didn't say, Mom, you don't have to do this?
She knows. My daughter actually wrote a wonderful, wonderful piece about this, and she, which is on the web, about how she knows it's important to me, how she knows this story is important to me, and that she'll support me. I raise my children to be independent and happy, I hope, and I hope someday they feel strongly about something, and they'll probably pay me back, and it'll be something that'll scare the heck out of me, but I think they understand that. My 15-year-old son, it scared him. And 15-year-old, you know, football players don't quite talk to you the way my daughter can talk to me about these things. I know he is. We talk about it, but he's such a wonderful kid, and he supports me too. And he gave me, I love this story, because I just had a birthday, and I had just gotten back from Iraq 2 days before, and he gave me some soaps and little lotions and stuff, and he said, I hope these brighten your day in Iraq next time.
Well, what surprised me, I was thinking about this the other day, is how much of the best reporting coming out of Iraq is from women. Ann Garrels has made NPR proud, but there have been many others. Do you think that this isn't new? Women have covered other wars, but do you think Iraq has changed the equation to some degree?
I think probably you have far more women covering conflict now, which is might be why you're noticing them. Plus, you've got really, really good women covering this war, like Dan Garrels, Kimberly Dozier. I mean, there are amazing. I'll tell you one thing, and you know, I'm of a generation that sort of had to fight my way in, and I part of that was, you know, I want to do it just like everybody else. I don't want to have this gender separation. But in the last few years, I mean, first of all, I don't think I have to be a guy to be successful or to be good at what I am. In fact, quite the opposite. I am a woman. I am a mother. I approach things through my own experiences. We all do. We all try to be objective, but that is who I am.
Well, there's still a debate over just how much involvement women should have in combat.
What I've seen, they are amazing over there. They are just amazing.
Meanwhile, we have a situation that's now being called a civil war, and nobody seems to have any solution. We have this surge going on. Doesn't seem to be doing any good. What's your sense that it's likely the next president will just pull up stakes as we did in Vietnam and get us out of there?
Boy, I don't know, but my last trip there was, even though there were areas, El Anbar seemed to be improved somewhat, Ramadi, where I'd been several months before that, there was some improvement. But I've also spent years seeing improvement, and then it pushes somewhere else and pushes somewhere else. There's so many wars going over there, so many different kinds. One of the things I noticed when I was there is I could tell how many times people were deployed by what they called the enemy. If they called them the anti-Iraqi forces, I knew they were there the second year of the war. And I'd say to them afterwards, you know, they don't call them that anymore. you must have been here in the second deployment, right? And they said, how'd you know that? But, I mean, we've got insurgents, we've got sectarian violence, we've got terrorists with Al-Qaeda. We've got common criminals. I mean, I think Bob Gates, the new Secretary of Defense, said there are four wars over there, at least.
Martha Raddatz's book, The Long Road Home, A Story of War and Family, is published by Putnam. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.